Hello, welcome again to RTE's Your Politics podcast, our weekly look at politics from Leinster House.
There is trouble in paradise. The government parties have fallen out with each other.
No, we're only a year and a half in government.
In
terms of this arrangement.
There's a constant charge against me, because he has no case against us when it comes to
subs.
My charge against him is he's obsessed with innuendo and conspiracy theories.
There is something incredibly demoralising and abstract about this annual pantomime.
Yeah, we're in the Houses of Parliament on national television.
Hello, you're very welcome again to RTE's Your Politics podcast from a positively spring-like Leinster House, although I'm really only talking about the weather outside because inside it's been a lot stormier. We'll talk about that now with our editor David Murphy and correspondents Micheál Lehane and Paul Cunningham. Micheál, on the various health problems besetting the government at the start of this week, the nurses' strike, cervical check, always with us, and of course the children's hospital. Would it be fair to say that Simon Harris, despite facing a motion of no confidence next week, is through the gap?
Yeah, through the gap. Damaged, though, in some ways, but a survivor, and has proven that and has got through what at the beginning of the week looked like a serious crisis with all kinds of question marks about his long-term political health in motion at that point. But he came through it, and the nurses' strike, at least on its way to resolution, was a plus for him. And as well as that, something else happened. Collective responsibility seemed to come back into Cabinet, and Pascal Donoghue started. It changed from last week where he was talking about the minister could have been more helpful if he had told him certain things at certain times. But of course, a parliamentary party meeting followed that where there were serious criticisms made about what was perceived by some as an effort to throw Simon Harris under the bus. So everyone walked together, a phalanx-like movement that helped Simon Harris. And by last night, there is a spring in his step. He's back in the Dáil and he's in control. But people look across this government now and there are some key tenets and some key things that were essential to their identity that perhaps have been damaged. And one of them is fiscal responsibility, prudence, being good with the money. And that matters to Fine Gael voters, and they know it matters. And that has somewhat been diminished. There is no doubt about that. And that will scare many of them as the prospect of at least local and European elections come into view. And I think Pascal Donoghue particularly will be mindful of that. And there were times this week as Simon Harris's demeanour became a little bit more resolute and resilient, where Pascal Donoghue could be seen at times slumping in the Dáil chamber. That changed as the week went on, but there's no doubt that that is something that is in play now. And I thought the clumsiness of the entire thing from a government point of view, and clumsiness is a euphemism, and it has been a week of euphemisms too, where cuts have been described as reprofiling and you're not allowed to say cuts, or at the very least savings. It was summed up by Leo Varadkar when he spoke about the past mess ups around spending, the poor tunnel, other things. They're from a far off time. They have nothing to do with us. But this is here now, and it's exceptional. But I think from the opposition, that is the core point. This is entirely of this government's making.
Yeah, I don't think the nurses thing is fully done and dusted. Now, we can see that what the government have really done here is they've taken the same pool of money and they've moved a few things around in order to boost it for certain nurses. However, they are giving the nurses a lot less overall than what they were looking for. It's interesting to listen to the kind of message the government had around that, because they didn't want to push that message too hard, because otherwise the nurses won't back the deal. And it's a tricky one for them. At the same time, all the other unions are looking on and they're trying to figure out, have the nurses as an overall group really got a pay rise or not? And that's why the devil on this is really in the detail. And it'll be interesting to see if other trade unions follow suit.
And Paul, this brings us back to the question of, you know, Fine Gael, ever since the recession, ever since they came in with Labour in the darkest days when the Troika was here, they've sold the message, you know, we're the ones who can deliver competence. We're the ones you can rely on to take the tough decisions. And whether it's cervical check, whether it's the children's hospital, whether it's their much vaunted public sector pay deal, there's now going to be huge questions for Fine Gael to answer in terms of delivery.
Yeah, Fine Gael prides itself on being fiscally literate.
and it opposes this whole idea of populist politics, and that takes you back to the general election where one particular party leader said if the Guards want more, should just give it to them. And that's an anathema to Fine Gael. And the difficulty for them, because they are on the move into local elections, into European election, possibly, Anya, possibly a general election this year, is they've got a big target on their back and it says NCH. €500 million. Or maybe, if Mick Wallace is right, the total bill could be €2.2 billion. They've got a big target on their back, those Fine Gael candidates, and it really rankles. And they are upset at how it happened, and they're not through the gap in the hedge just yet completely, because at the end of March you've got the PwC report and more nastiness is likely to come out.
There's something the politicians across Leinster House have been saying to me this week. What do you guys think? They've been saying the Children's Hospital, they're saying this one is really connecting with the public. This one is really making people angry out there. Is that just something people are saying in here, or is there a sense that that's a real problem?
There seemed to be something that had got lost among politicians, and that is that people had become very mindful of cuts and what small amounts of money meant and the pain that they caused. And suddenly the notion that 450 million wouldn't rankle with the public or wouldn't cause a great deal of outrage seems surprising, but that seems to be what happened. And even when the government began its efforts this week to try and deal with that impact and to make further savings, as they like to call them, the fact that you don't get a breakdown of the 24 million in health, exactly what that means and how it's going to be spread out. And when you put it directly to the finance minister, he says, well, I can't tell you that at the moment. I need to look through this through the summer to tell you. At the same time, it's not that long ago when you had very small amounts of money being taken from key services in health and people knew the impact that they could have. This vagueness around things at the moment is only adding to the problem. And it's surprising too, for another reason, from what I'm hearing in the exchanges that took place between finance and other departments last Friday, is that they were looking for specifics in finance. They wanted to know exactly where that money was coming from. But at the same time, across departments, whether it's communications or culture or health, the breakdown hasn't been issued still.
And a question too about DEPRA, a question about the administration, the governance, the capacity to deliver at that level and ministerial oversight of same, David.
Yeah, I think so. When you have a project of that scale that runs that far over budget, or is projected to run that far over budget, it just shows there's a massive problem there in terms of governance. It's worth remembering as well that in the old days when Ireland ran itself into serious trouble, when there was an overspend, they simply borrowed more. What this government is trying to say is we're not going to borrow more, we're actually going to defer some of our spending. But it's worth bearing in mind, they've 100 million is going to be deferred in capital spending to make up for this overshoot on the hospital this year. That means there's going to have to be further €350 million or so in 2020. So the feel from this is going to go on for some time.
All right, let's move on to something else that feels like it's going to be going on for some time. And that is Brexit. Another debate, another possible parliamentary debate defeat for Theresa May. It's also being, what's been really, really weird this week, David, has been this sight of the UK going, no, we're in the middle of really important negotiations here. And Brussels kind of going, well, yeah, there's a few photo ops and a few dinners, but negotiations? What negotiations?
Well, you'd really wonder why Theresa May hasn't locked herself in a dark room with her advisers and say, let's come up with the alternative plan and let's see what we can put to the British Parliament. Instead, she's been in Brussels, she's been in Belfast, she's been in Dublin, and she's been talking to people. But it hasn't really shone an awful lot of light on what's going to happen. And therefore, people are jumping to a conclusion that perhaps she's trying to run down the clock.
And this is where, and actually we'll play you a clip here now, and it's an interesting exchange. It comes from our European Parliament report. Conor McMorrow is talking to UK MEP Seb Dance, who's talking about the backstop.
There are many, many British people who completely understand and recognise the importance of the Good Friday Agreement, not least myself, because having worked in the Northern Ireland office when the last phase of devolution was being delivered, the importance was obvious. What the choice in front of us is quite clear and unavoidable. The fundamental choice is this: you cannot leave the customs union and expect there not to be a hard border with the area that you are no longer in a customs union with. It is as simple and as straightforward as that. So you either have Northern Ireland as part of the customs union with a border in the Irish Sea, or you have the entire United Kingdom in the same customs union as the rest of the European Union. That is the choice. There is no other way of doing this, and we can dance around it and pretend there are technological solutions and all the rest of it, all the while ignoring the fact that, of course, if you simply unilaterally declare that you won't have any border, which the EU could do or the United Kingdom could do, you then fall foul of WTO rules, which are clear and simple. If you offer one thing to one third country, you have to offer it to all. And of course, nobody would be prepared to do that because it would make an entire nonsense of the tariff system. Okay. That's the fundamental choice. And it is maddening that with 44 days to go until Brexit, we still haven't got anyone in government willing to face up to that choice. The backstop is non-negotiable.
Paul, that argument that the UK is making, that there has to be some give here, a lot of speculation that it will now be the European Council in late March where there may be some additional wording, some codicil perhaps, or some extra reassurances that might get this deal over the line?
Yeah, the European institutions have been pretty clear that the withdrawal agreement, once concluded, will not be reopened. So that's a fact. Next thing you move on to is, what else can you do? Is it the political declaration, something added on to it, something which is going to be able to say the only time this backstop or safety net is ever going to be used is under circumstances that are so rare or so extreme that it's never going to happen, and hope that that is going to be of use to Theresa May, so that when she does bring it to Parliament, maybe on the 26th of March or whatever, people will feel that they're under so much pressure and they maybe got a bit from Brussels that it'll go through. But as David said, there's no change in Theresa May's approach. It's her withdrawal agreement with a little bit more, and placing all the pressure back on MPs to say, there's the cliff, do you want to drive the bus off?
It couldn't be more depressing at the moment, this story, particularly when you see Andrea Leadsom on Valentine's Day quoting Valentine's ditties in the middle of a Brexit debate. It's just...
our government, but there was a couple of... Valentine's floating around in Leinster House.
But I'll tell you
so
one other consequence of Brexit. That phrase, was it Barry Cowan said it to Simon Harris Micheál, but for Brexit you'd be gone. Fianna Fáil, how restive are they? We all heard about this row at the parliamentary party meeting. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, there is a view in Fianna Fáil, isn't there, that they should never have extended, and that is amplified all the time by John McGuinness. At the same time, the argument for staying in and for staying in for Brexit has been articulated in the most pure and clear terms in recent times from the likes of Dara Cleary and Barry Cowan. And I think what you have there is an effort to say, we've done it, but it isn't actually going to be that long. That seems to be the subtext of what's going on. And for the first time, you hear whispers coming out saying, which Micheál Martin himself will go as soon as he gets clarity. And that's the first time that even those whispers or rumours are coming. Yes, they are necessary to keep the party together because of the discomfort that Fianna Fáil are in. But I think you do have a real sense that Brexit clarity of any kind will pave the way for an earlier than expected general election here.
OK, call it. Go on, Micheál. When do you think it's going to be?
September is the latest rumour, so let's go with that.
It must be something to do with spring being in the air. The politicians, no matter what they're rowing about inside, the spring air may be
well,
making them
I think
pink.
That row inside about the children's hospital, I think the general public and Fianna Fáil supporters have been giving their Fianna Fáil politicians a lot of heat on that and saying, why are you supporting these guys? Look, they're not even sticking with their own mantra of being fiscally responsible. And I think that kind of pressure is making some senior figures in Fianna Fáil, as Micheál said there, you know, they're thinking actually as soon as there's a clear path in terms of what's happening with Brexit, then we need to go to the country, and they're kind of shifting a little bit.
One Fianna Fáil TD said to me that it wouldn't be the day after a Brexit deal was passed, if it's passed, there would be some legislative responsibilities to get some stuff through. The second that was done, the firing gun or the starting gun of the election would be
fired. And it is the hospital crisis that has been the defining moment in all this, the defining moment for the kind of maturing, ageing and the glass being taken off the government, and Fianna Fáil just really running out of road and patience, I think.
So elections, the online space, transparency, data, all of those questions, these all came up, of course, during the 8th referendum last year. They're pressing, of course, in terms of the European and local elections again, and the question being how much can we trust what's happening online and what regulation should there be? So I'm going to talk about this now with James Lawless, Fianna Fáil's spokesperson on science, technology, research and development, who's got a piece of legislation he's trying to progress on this at the moment. And also by Liz Carolan, who's co-founder of the Transparent Referendum Initiative. And Liz, maybe you'd start by telling us, 2018, the year we all found out about Cambridge Analytica, the year of the Mueller probe got going in earnest. Was 2018 the year that things began to shift, to change in terms of political campaigning, possible manipulation online?
I think something did fundamentally shift. I mean, I noticed it myself. I've been sort of around these, working around these issues for a few years, and trying to explain it down the pub to anyone, you sort of get an eye roll or, you know, conspiracy theories, etc. And I think, you know, there was, well, kind of globally, like the Cambridge Analytica scandal, I think, was one that really, it just connected with people. They could see a link between some of these abstract concepts and their own lives. And I think here in Ireland, there was a lot of focus on this question around the referendum. And I think people could see the quantity mm-hmm. of online paid content that was doing the rounds. It was sort of a part of their lives. And actually, some of the Eurobarometer polling that came out the second half of last year showed that Irish people are sort of some of the most clued into this and some of the most concerned about it.
And we saw in the referendum campaign, James Lawless, the Facebook ban on foreign paid national, foreign paid material, and the Google ban on all political ads. We've also had Google recently talking about actions they'd be taking in terms of the European elections. Is it good enough? Is it safe enough for all of us to sit back and think, well, we can trust Facebook, we can trust Google, they're going to sort this out for us?
Yeah, well, I mean, I would hope that if we've learned anything from the crash and from recent history and recent international and local events, it's that self-regulation is never a good idea. Trusting an industry to regulate itself, be it the banks, be it the drones, which I was talking about recently, be it the online space, and the tech giants, you know, have balance sheets greater than many countries. So allowing them to set the rules, I think, is not a good idea. It's also been proven time and again that when they do set the rules, they will do as little as possible, as late as possible. And I think in the case of Facebook, there was actually a leaked internal memo that said delay, obfuscate, deny, which frustrated me as someone who is a public representative and politician, have been actually engaging with Facebook public affairs people and, you know, feeling some kind of goodwill coming back from it, that actually meant much of what I think was tactical, is very frustrating. So essentially, no, I don't think we should let the tech giants set the rules. I think, yes, we welcome them to the discussion and we avail of their expertise and we look at their mm-hmm. engineering teams to come up with ideas. But as legislators, we have a responsibility to protect our democracy, to protect our state, protect our electoral system and the integrity of that, and put the rules in place. And I mean, I attempted to do this, still am attempting to do this. I introduced legislation 2 years ago now, it was late 2017, came before the Dáil. It ticks, I think, all the main boxes in terms of transparency, who's running an ad, who is paying for an ad, where there's fake accounts, and I'll come back maybe in a few minutes to fake activity, which is quite insidious as well. It was all in there, and I think it was balanced quite finely with freedom of speech, which of course is so important to protect. But the government, the Fine Gael government, which is still in place, actually voted against it.
It's there in confidence and supply, isn't it? It's supposed to be a priority issue, this piece of legislation.
That's right. So when we renegotiated the confidence and supply to cover a new year, to get us all through Brexit, there were four pieces of legislation, Fianna Fáil legislation, that were called out in that agreement. And my bill, my social media transparency bill, is one of those that actually has been agreed between the government and ourselves, that said this is something you have to prioritise, you have to pass, you have to get it moving. So that's on the table, but it hasn't
progressed. On the table where, James?
Well, that's exactly the point. You know, it still hasn't got to committee. I mean, we've had it in committee in the sense of we've had stakeholders.
All right, so it's hanging there in the system. It hasn't got to committee. We all know that Brexit is going to squeeze everything else off the table. And we're looking at, you know, local European elections and a couple of referendums coming up in the early summer. So is it going to be in place by then?
Well, we'll have to ask the government, because essentially the government have to issue a money message, which is a technical device. Without getting into the technicalities, only the government can release the money message to let it progress. And actually, when you mentioned Brexit, you know, I mean, I know Liz talked about some of the campaigns internationally. again, we're seeing there are voices for a hard Brexit. There are, I would think, international subversive forces at work, state actors trying to push for things like a hard Brexit because it's damaging to Western democracy, it's damaging to Ireland. We have an opportunity on this island. You know, we could have actually led the way 2 years ago. The government chose not to. But even still, we can actually get there fast. We've got legislation ready to go.
And this whole idea of the online space is a wild west for democracy and the manipulation of that space by dark forces. You know, a lot of people might think that's a conspiracy theory, you know, but talk to us. I know you're just back from Ukraine, Liz. Russia, of course, we know from the Mueller investigation, we know from the Brexit campaigns, there's questions about Russian involvement there. But also that there is an agenda here in terms of the European elections.
Very much so. And so when I met with some sort of fact checkers and people working on this field in Ukraine, and they would talk about some relentless use of sort of tactics in order to try and sort of hammer home some particular narratives in Ukraine. So they might use 15 lies a day, which fact checkers are trying to sort of scramble to catch up with. But they're trying to sort of deliver like a big picture message, which is that Ukraine is in crisis and that the West is in crisis. And, you know, there are, you know, there's a lot of sort of like fear that we'll see some sort of transnational kind of collaboration between some of these forces in the elections. And their goal isn't necessarily, you know, we've seen this in the US, we saw this in Brexit, the goal isn't necessarily always to get one candidate to win. We sort of have this horse race approach sometimes to looking at election campaigns as if everybody wants to sort of win. Actually, a lot of them are using, kind of hijacking this period of debate in order to try and sort of push forward messages, but also to get people to distrust things. And the erosion of trust is one of the most damaging things that can happen in a democracy.
And there have been questions, haven't there, about Russian troll farms and their involvements, for instance, with the Gilets Jaunes protests, which are still going on in France, with the far right in Italy, and we've seen that the right and populism there have combined to come up with, certainly from a European point of view, a very challenging mix, and right throughout Eastern Europe. And there is, it's believed, President Putin has a specific agenda there of fostering that destabilisation. Is that a left-wing conspiracy too far, or is that close to the truth?
Well, there's some things that we know. We know that motivation is there, and we know that sort of certain actors have undertaken activities that are towards the motivation that you just described. But we also know that the opportunity is there, and it's there in the technology, which allows, you know, still in Ireland, anyone anywhere in the world to target Irish people or any other European citizen based upon a sophisticated analysis of who they are, what they're afraid of, where they're based, what their family structure looks like, to target them with information that nobody else necessarily knows that they are seeing, and to do that relentlessly day in, day out, without ever having to reveal their identity or the source of the money, either to that person or to anyone else. So the opportunity is there in the technology. It's also there in the law. And I think even, James's bill is very important. I think it's that fundamental thing. So I think it's that step of us having at least visibility of what's going on, which is the first step to addressing a problem. But, you know, I think a lot of this comes down
to... So that if you're getting a political ad or a piece of propaganda that is specifically targeted to you by people who know a lot about you from analysing your data through all their algorithms and everything, at least you would know it's propaganda.
So it's that, but it's also for people like yourself and journalists to get a big picture view and to be able to look and see, you know, okay, not just what is James doing in his constituency, you know, advertising, which, and there's a lot of political advertising is perfectly legitimate, but who are the kind of private and secret accounts that exist that are targeting James's voter with maybe lies about him or with, you know, just sort of things that are trying to undermine people's trust in the government. It's not just about what the candidates are doing. And our law at the moment, our electoral law, is fundamentally out of date. I've been to global meetings of electoral commissions and nobody from Ireland is there because we don't have anybody with responsibility for elections.
Well, there is talk, isn't there, James, from the government of moving towards setting up a permanent electoral commission. Again, I don't know where that is in the timetable, given everything else that's on the table. I presume you would argue we need one like yesterday.
Absolutely, and I totally agree. You know, the points Liz makes about our electoral laws being out of date. I mean, our electoral laws largely date back to 1992. The bulk of them were put in place then. You know, there are already multiple 30 or 40 offences about if I put a poster on a lamppost, what kind of font, you know, what, you know, joking, but you know what declarations go on it, who paid for it, who put it up there, all that kind of stuff is there for the print and paper, you know, type materials for a pamphlet that goes in a letterbox, for a poster that goes in a lamppost. It's there in law. It actually doesn't get prosecuted, by the way. Nobody actually follows through on those offences. We saw in the Eighth Amendment campaign, there were complaints about certain posters not having the required disclosure, and nobody quite knew. SIPO said it wasn't them, it wasn't the Gardaí, it wasn't DPP, it wasn't the advertising standards, and they went in circles. So there's a huge issue on that, and we badly need an electoral commission. Now, I've put this to Minister Murphy in the Dáil on many occasions. He keeps saying it's on the way, but it's been on the way for years.
There was a more specific commitment made, wasn't there? That it would be in place, probably not for this summer, but definitely by the end of the year.
Exactly, but we're missing all these targets. I mean, you know, the Eighth Amendment was a great opportunity, and actually in the end it sort of happened because it got to crisis point when the platforms themselves sort of self-regulated. We hoped we'd have something in place for that. Now the European elections are coming down the track fast. We hope to have something. You know, we need something in place for then. There's talk about maybe the platforms having some kind of self-regulation again. But how many more chances are we going to miss? You know, the European elections will be over. We're talking about a general election in Ireland. You know, are we going to try and get ready for that? But I think as well, there's two different types of things. There is the political advertising, which is kind of bona fide, like the James Lawless TD running an ad for myself, or another opponent running an ad for themselves or a party. There's also this kind of dark stuff where, and people like
the
journalists,
negative stuff.
The negative stuff, yeah, and also the opinion forming stuff, where quite a fringe viewpoint, quite an extreme viewpoint, like the Billy Jones or the Putin sponsored stuff, or the hard Brexit type material. And it's being promoted by very specific and very sophisticated fake accounts who will target the likes of broadcasters, the likes of politicians, and they will try to promote a view and magnify that view to make it appear that this particular viewpoint is far more popular than it actually is and pervasive.
And this brings us back, of course, to this phrase, fake news, Liz. And I noticed even recently, you know, when we go through our phone lines, we all respond emotionally to certain things. There are also, you know, if I see certain things that expressing opinions I don't like, I'd be more inclined not to follow them. So we all end up in this self-reinforcing bubble. In many ways, we're kind of programmed, aren't we, to respond to these programmers out to manipulate us. We're perfectly programmed.
Yeah, I mean, I think a bit of it is our own personal choices, but that's been really reinforced by sort of algorithms, so kind of the robots behind these tools that choose what it is that we see.
And do you think people get, when they're, you know, using their phone, posting their pictures, connecting with their friends, do you think people get how much you are a piece of data in a public space that somebody is making money out of, somebody else might be manipulating?
Well, you know, there's that kind of trite phrase now, but that says, you know, if you're not paying, you're the product, you're not the consumer. And you know, and I think that people are starting to see that when it comes to Facebook, you're the thing being sold. And you know, it's not your personal data that's being sold, it's access to you, which is actually a little bit even more insidious. You know, it's access to your phone, you know, when you're sitting on the couch in the evening, access to your eyeballs is being sold. And that's been sold based on knowledge of everything you've ever liked, who your friends are, you know, even things like where have you been during the day, right? All of that information has been gathered, and I think we are starting to understand that.
All right. Well, all I can say is people should be using their phones, obviously, to listen to this podcast. Otherwise,
very
be very
so.
Careful. Thanks a million, both of you, for joining us. Cheers.
Thank you.
Thanks a million.
Well, we've run out of time, if not road, at this particular point. Just to let you know, we're really, really pleased with the reaction we're getting for people who've been tuning in and listening to the podcast. If you like it, please subscribe, leave a message, or let us know what you like, what you don't like, and what you'd like more of. This is Áine Lawler, leaving you from a spring-like Leinster house with thoughts of elections in the air. And we'll talk to you again next week.